Dr. Bosworth, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate you joining us.
You bet. It's great to be here, Charles Michael.
Yeah, thank you. Why? I mean, just gonna ask off the top, why are you running for office? Why did you choose to do this?
The first time I stood up and prayed to God to have courage, I was 7. I was on the playground in Plankington, and I was tired of watching what that 6th grader did to the 3rd grader every day. And I stood between them. And by the time I got home, Plankington is small enough that my mother knew what I had done. And she had all these phone calls saying, doesn't she get that that was dangerous? That was scary? She could have really gotten hurt. And my mother passed on that anxiety and stress to me. And I said, yeah, Mom, but now everybody knows. And I think that character has been recurring in my life, one theme after the next, that I tell a story when I'm introducing myself about it being 12 and yelling at my dad. I'm in a hog barn, and like every 12-year-old girl, I feel, you know, unique. And I've got my hair wrapped in saran wrap because I don't like how stinky my hair gets when we go into the hog barn. And I tell him I don't like being a hog farmer's daughter. And my dad turns back to me and says, it's a good thing you live in America, because you can start out right here, girl. And as long as you keep your eye on the long game, you can become anything you want with your faith, your grit, and determination. And I've used that. It's been a recurring theme. And as a first, I'm the first one in my family to ever go through medical school and become a doctor. I stand up for the elderly and the poor, Medicaid and Medicare. And last year, when they have some traditions in South Dakota, one of which is they do a poll. And we're in the spring of last year when the poll comes out to say, doctor, would you recommend to your children to become a doctor? And usually, especially in South Dakota, 85, 90%, yes, it's an incredibly rewarding career. 15% said yes last year. And I was horrified. And I look around the room, and the apathy is palpable. They've given up. There's people playing Angry Birds and Words with Friends. They're not. And my heart is pounding with, this is us. This is our industry. We are the ones leading it. And when we step back and say we give up, that is why the government can step in and say, we're going to tell you how to do medicine. And so I looked around the room and said, if not me, who will? And then I realized over the course of about 40 days where I really was prayerful about, God, is this the right direction for me? I realized that I wasn't saying the same thing to my kids that my dad said to me, that you can start out anywhere. And because of the way this country works, you can be anything. I don't say that to my kids anymore. And I need to. And it means America needs to return the government's control back to where it should have been and isn't anymore. The overreach is unbelievable, and we let it happen. And that's why I run.
One of your top priorities is to repeal Obamacare. What's it going to take to do that? Do you think that's really possible?
I do think that's possible. I think it will take folks who are used to standing up. It is not for the soft of character. It is not for those who look around and treat compliments different than criticisms. You need to know what you're doing and why you're there. And I also know that when I, as an independent doctor, I run my own business. I'm a small business. I serve the patients of elderly and poor, Medicaid and Medicare. And I'm on the front lines asking them questions that I really need to know in order to help them with their mental health, with their addiction, with their blood pressure, with their cancer. But that information shouldn't be going to the IRS. That I am applying and have been in the process of doing something called patient-centered medical home, which most of them are government-funded. I am not. I am a private company. And when they ran the report saying, Dr. Bosworth, can you prove to us that you can do all the things in your system that you say you can, which is how you get this status, they said, can you run me a report of all the patients in your practice that have a gun, can you run me a report of all the patients in your practice that are depressed? And I take care of, you know, people as they age through lots of tough times. I'm like, yes, I screen for that. Much like I screen their cholesterol for heart disease, I screen for depression. So I ran the report. And then they said, now we'd like you to couple that report with one of the following questions. And it wasn't a mandatory question. It was the fourth question down that said, can you tell me all those patients that have a gun in their home? And I'm like, why is that question even on here? This report is going to the U.S. government. There are history books about doing this in the past. It does not work well out well for our people. It is not okay for you to touch that Second Amendment that way. And it was another place where I could feel a fire saying, somebody stand up. Do they see what they've said yes to? And so when you look at what is the core foundation to that law, is that it is lying over the IRS. It was considered constitutional because it's a tax. It is using our Constitution in a way that was manipulated to get a law through that was never constitutional in what they're doing with it now. The way they sold it, the way they marketed it to the, not just the people who voted for it, the legislators didn't understand it either. And now we're here in a place that it is so violating for what they are doing to the rights of the patient that I couldn't watch that sixth grader do that anymore. And I can't watch what the U.S. government is doing to the people that I took an oath to serve. And I thought that it would always be as a doctor serving them for 40 years. I never imagined it would be as a politician, as a senator.
There are those who argue, though, I want to ask that prior to Obamacare, maybe even now still, it's insurance companies that were really getting in the way of the doctor-patient relationship. And insurance companies were keeping all this kind of data you're talking about, and they were the ones dictating what kind of care a doctor could give to a patient. Is it any different now under Obamacare than it was prior?
So it is the same core problem. Before, at least you had the competition between those insurance companies that you could, as the business owner, as the doctor, you could say, I choose not to see patients under that insurance because of what they do with their data. And then they had to compete with other people on the market. Right now, we've passed that up to a level that there is no competition, and the abuse of power is exponential with what they'll do with that information. Let me tell you a story about how this is a history lesson of being abused. There is a great data collection that happened prior to the Civil War on is this a free black man in South Carolina? And if he was a free black man with his family, he had to register with the courthouse every year to prove again that he was free. It was a huge status symbol with his race at that time. And every year they were very careful to make sure that happened so that they could continue to live as a free person in South Carolina. 150 years later, the state legislators had a problem with their budget, that the education system was costing far more, $9 to every one, if the person's skin was white. It's 150 years later. So a legislator goes back and says, you know, we have a good lineage now that says some of these kids in the white schools really have a black ancestor. And if we just move them from the white school to the black school, we'll be back in budget. When they collected that information, there was no sight that's how it would be used. And they're dead and gone. But the data is collected, it's put in the government, and it will be misused. There are history books from every country that once you collect this and you start to have that much power in your government, it's why the America has been the shining city on the hill, is we haven't allowed that. And we are at a time that is allowing it. And people are just saying it's too big to tackle. We can't undo it. There is no hope. We can't repeal Obamacare. We just overturned health care. We can repeal this. We just need leaders who say, I am not looking around. I'm not here for the special interests. I'm here for the patients that I've been standing up for.
You list several other priorities in your platform, including balancing the federal budget, securing the border, traditional marriage. You only want to serve 2 terms in office. You believe in term limits. Why are these things important to you as a South Dakotan?
Yes, the tapestry of the United States Senate was never supposed to be predominantly career politicians and lawyers. It was supposed to represent our country with that diverse tapestry. There should be teachers. There should be doctors. There should be mothers. There should be landowners and business owners and bankers. There shouldn't just be 80% of career politicians looking for the next rung on their ladder and lawyers. Now, they should be there to represent. We are making laws. They are the experts. But when the when the voices that collect them have become so legalistic that our whole country behaves after 40 years with that predominance in the U.S. Senate of that much legalistic behavior, we now have a very legalistic environment in our culture. Oh, don't break that rule. Don't challenge that rule. And it's in your healthcare. It's in your jails. It's in the way we treat addicts. It's in the way we school our children. Don't break that rule. Don't challenge that authority. Don't stand out. And it is ruining the way this country was meant to be. So term limits would, I mean, I do think that if you can't get something done in 12 years, you should be fired. I mean, you're there to do a job. Also, I'm a physician, but psychology of change is how I get patients to do things that they didn't want to do. You know, how do you motivate behavior? And when you have a deadline to prove that you could get the job done, the tenacity that you use to get the job done is far different. When you think you're there forever, it changes everything.
Some of your opponents, especially on the Democratic side, charge that it's not necessarily big government that's the problem and big government spending. It's big corporations that have too much power over our government and that are controlling our government and pushing it in the direction of to make it work for the ultra-wealthy rather than for the people. Where do you stand on this? Do you see this as a divide between two parties, two philosophies, or where do you stand on this issue?
I think that there is several parallels between corporate medicine, corporate businesses, and the way the government has been working. There are lots of parallels in there. In the name of protecting innovation, small business, we are in America where that is where the innovators should be able to survive. That when the law has come in and made the rules so high that the innovator, the one in the garage who has the idea, let's take healthcare. We have open sourced Watson. Remember Watson when he was on, they were on Jeopardy and, you know, it was a year of could you outsmart Watson? Okay, so Watson gets done with Jeopardy and they put Watson in the front lobby of three hospitals. And for over a year, they continue to change the algorithm so that before you go see your doctor, you checked in with Watson. And he asked you the questions that the doctor was too busy to ask. He made sure that the background history of your social history was there. You know, he asked the questions of sex, drugs, rock and roll that sometimes the nurse would skip because it was embarrassing for her, not for you, for her. And the data that Watson would say is, of all the things this patient's complaining about, here's the list that the doctor should consider. And you know what? It helps. There is a lot to consider in medicine today. On January 1st, that information was open sourced, free to the public, free to people who want to take that and innovate with it. But what has our law done in the United States is that it is an extension of the physician. And if there is any advice being given by that device, we're now going to tax it. So what happens with these innovators? They can be creative and come up with a way to say, how can we don't have a doctor shortage. We have an innovation shortage, that there are awesome tools out there, of which they're going to other countries because there they don't get taxed. So when you ask, is corporate healthcare, is corporate medicine, are corporate businesses paralleled and are they the problem or is the U.S. government? Their lobbyist system has been so intertwined. I want you to show me the difference in specifics. What I think people need to keep their eye on are how this country has always stayed at the peak front of innovation and leadership and an economy that is a superstar is because we've rewarded the innovator. We've left a place for him at the table. That yes, you do have a corporate medicine to compete with, and let's hope we've got the tenacity in this generation to do that. But as our legal system and our government has rewarded through the lobbyist system that is there, the bigger the corporation, the better they pay the systems of the PAP, you know, political action committees, and that allegiance is real. As a physician, that was taken away before I got into medicine. So the most a drug rep can give me is a pen, and that's best. Their job is to educate me and to make me aware of their product. I have no allegiances. I don't get back pay. Why does not the U.S. government do that? There is clear science that shows when you start to bribe people, they change how they behave. put those rules to the U.S. government and the lobbyists that are there. Transparency needs to happen. Someone needs to stand up and then not get blown around when it gets tense.
I want to ask you, you're one of five people running in this primary for the Republican nomination to the U.S. Senate in South Dakota. Mike Rounds is seen by many pundits as you know, the front runner. A lot of people just consider him a shoo-in. Why do you think you can beat Mike Rounds, such a candidate with such a strong name recognition in South Dakota and such a history here?
I believe in the single mom who's given me $10. I believe in the teacher who's given me $50. I've got over 21,000 people who've contributed to my campaign, with the average contribution being $45. That is the people's choice. The average contribution on Mike Rounds' campaign is $10,000. As a single individual, the most you can give is $2,600. Who can give $10,000? The political action committees can. That's the PAC money coming from D.C. If you want the lobbyist's choice, that's Mike Rounds. He's bought and paid for, and they know how he'll vote. If you want the people's choice, $45, 21,000 people. That's a movement.
Are you worried at all about critics who worry that the Republican Party is becoming too fractured, and that the party is, there's too much infighting in the party, and this could weaken the party in South Dakota for the long term November election if this primary, you know, gets ugly, for example?
Our Republican Party needs to be brought together. There is not a better example of who did this than Ronald Reagan, where he had his eye on the long game. He could see where he was going, but he could sit at a table with people who adamantly opposed what he was doing and could collaborate on how to keep them at the table and in the discussion without compromising his views. You come to any Lincoln Day dinner, and I'm one of the youngest people there. If you want to speak to the next generation, yet be able to bridge to the elders that have been imprinted in my life, the next candidate for the United States Senate in South Dakota will shape where the Republican Party in South Dakota goes. And I would have you carefully consider, what do you want the Republican Party to look like? If you want the next generation of innovators, of business owners, of farmers, of Christians to step up and say, here's an example that I can identify with, then be careful who you choose in this election.
I need to ask you also, some of your opponents have been critical of you. They say that they've accused you of being involved in some unethical activities. There are bloggers out there who cite your involvement, alleged involvement in a land raffle that didn't work out, they say. They also say you've failed to pay some of your debts. They cite your former staffer, Ethan Crisp, in his resignation letter, is on some of the blogs out there. And I need to give you a chance to respond to some of these allegations.
Have you ever read the book Atlas Shrugged? There are people that are the spark plugs of our country. And when you stand up to do things, you don't get to say how it all turns out. That when I saw the elderly, the poor, and specifically the people returning from war not getting the care they needed, I didn't wait for the U.S. government to come with a program and say, this is how it's going to be solved. I looked around to say, what assets do I have? What talents did God give me? And I did something. I raffled off a piece of land that my husband bought me on our wedding day. We put it in a nonprofit, and we used the proceeds of that to run a program that wasn't happening in South Dakota. That's a brave thing to do. When you do things, you will find anybody to find, especially in the country where, just like Atlas Shrugged, there has grown this amount of people who said, I don't need to do anything to feel entitled, that I'm owed something that they don't work for. And when you show up to work for me, I'm going to give you a job and I'm not going to micromanage you. And when you do the job, I'll pay you what is decided. But if you don't show up for the job and still expect your paycheck, I'm not going to pay you. I think that's unethical. Where has the entitlement, how big will that entitlement grow? And where are the people to say, when you exploit that you think you are owed money, or you think that you understand this story of what that blogger who is being paid. We have under oath, he's being paid by D.C. to pay people to do this. So be careful what you read. This is the kind of behavior in the country that somebody needs to stand up and say, you want to use that to exploit who I am? No, it's not intimidating to me, because if you treat those criticisms just like you treat compliments and you're going to be a leader, you should treat them as equal. That when people say, oh, you're doing a great job, don't use that. When they say, oh, my goodness, you did that all wrong. You should, as a leader, it is your responsibility to weigh those equally with a reflection, but not an ego or a setback that isn't deserved. The story there is bigger, some of which I can't talk about. It's being litigated. And I will stand up for the people in this country who bravely say, I'm going to do something, and this is how our country has changed the whole world and how it treats its poor, its elderly, and its innovators. And we've lost sight of that. To reward people that don't do that, but instead use the media to exploit a place to say, if I can embarrass her, maybe she'll pay me. No, I won't.
Are you worried these allegations are hurting your campaign at all?
So I don't know if you read the newspaper 2 Sundays ago in the Argus Leader. When you're above the fold in the Argus Leader, you know you've arrived as a candidate. And we knew that the story was coming probably on Thursday. So unlike what most politicians would do, I knew there was a story coming. And I'm a doctor. I'm trained in crisis management, and I train my team to do that. So when we heard there was a story coming, I went to the Argus Leader and said, I hear you're writing a story. Are you sure you don't have further questions? And for 2 hours, I sat with the reporter, made sure all of his questions were answered. It was late on a Friday afternoon, and the story ran on Sunday. I don't think he used anything. I think he didn't write one word. And I'll be honest, Charles Michael, it was Sunday was a hard day. My preacher wouldn't look me in the eye because he had read the newspaper. And again, this is apropos for America. But the Facebook numbers dropped, the Twitter numbers dropped, the phone didn't ring, and the preacher won't look you in the eye. That's a tough day. But my team held. No one walked away. They knew the truth. They knew that this is part of the journey, that if you're going to do this, you had better be able to take that. And 2 days later was the highest to-date donation day in my campaign at $40,000 came through 2 days later. What does that say? That says most of America can see through the liberal writing behaviors of papers for people who have not done brave things, but they write about them. And they don't do it with the transparency that the people deserve. And by the end of that week, we had the highest Facebook numbers, the highest Twitter numbers, and topped out the end of the month at a very good month.
Dr. Bosworth, I understand part of your platform also is against abortion. Is this right?
You know, I grew up in a time where all the strong women that were in my life when I was 18 had the saying, keep the long arm of the law out of my uterus. And you're very impressionable. You're in college and you've got friends who had abortions and you journey with them and you watch. And I've said the words, at that time, you know, I've repeated the words, the long arm of the law in my uterus. I would think about that. Like, okay, why would they ever care? Why would it be there in the first place? And then you become a doctor, and you become a mother. And what has grown in the pro-life world is that this is way more of an issue than it ever was touted as. And that my generation of women are seeing that we are winning the war against abortion. That I never planned on this being a platform of something I would run for Senate with, but I always used it in my life. That I have an ultrasound the size of my iPhone, and that, you know, I take care of teens in crisis. And today when they come in crisis, it's a boy and a girl, and they're stressed out and they don't want their parents to know and they're very scared. And I've learned to shut up. And I usually hand the ultrasound base to the boy and I motioned to the girl to get up on the table, and I put the jelly on her tummy, and I find the baby. And you hold the silence long enough, usually the boy speaks next. "Doctor, is that our baby?" Yeah. They come in calling it a problem. They leave understanding this is a baby. And that technology has saved more lives than anything. Yeah. I'm not just a little bit pro-life.
Dr. Bosworth, thanks so much for your time today.
You bet. Thank you.